Let's pray. Be with us in this study, O Lord. Help us to see you in the pages of this book and fall in love with you more clearly again. Amen. So, we left off last week with Esther. We finished Ruth and Esther, and now we're ready for the poetry books. So, as a reminder, if you wanted to find those books, halfway in the middle of your Bible, depending on how much you have in your index, you'll be open kind of to the Psalms. If you're not in the Psalms, you're somewhere in the poetry books, because the book of Job is just before Psalms, and then Proverbs comes after it, and Ecclesiastes. So all the books that we're going to talk about now, you should be able to find pretty easily. All of the history books are before this little section. And then all the prophets follow this section. So let's let everyone find Job. Because we're going to be looking at some verses together. Job is just before Psalms. Okay, the book of Job is considered a literary marvel. It's written, the entire thing is written as a poem, and it's widely understood to be poetic. If you understood Hebrew, you could, it would actually look like poetry, the way it's laid out. It deals with the problem of undeserved suffering. It's the theodicy question again. We mentioned that last week. Because of the mention of the patriarchal sacrifice that we find in verse 5 of chapter 1, and we'll just look at that. So it was in the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them and rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of all. He's talking about his family. He's offering sacrifices for his family. Because Job is doing this, he's not a priest. It is assumed that this is during the patriarchal period, so before Moses. So technically, this history would fall like during Genesis. And that chronology handout I gave you, that's why you see Job up under Genesis. But because of its poetic form, it's lumped in our Bibles with the books of poetry. Okay? Does that make sense to everyone? So it's set in the time before the giving of the law. Now, because of its Hebrew form as poetry, that's why we find it located where it is. And so from chapter 1, verses 6, through chapter 2, verses 6, we have this dialogue between God and Satan about Job. God brings up Job as an exemplar human. And Satan claims he can bring Job down. And God allows Satan to prove his point with the stipulation that Satan cannot take Job's life. Job loses his children, his possessions, and finally his health. And in chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, we find that Job is struck with boils. He's sitting in ashes, lancing his oozing sores with a broken piece of pottery. It's kind of a really sad situation. The bulk of the remainder of the book is a conversation between Job's three friends, we put that in quotes, and Job. God finally speaks in chapters 38 through 41. In the last chapter, 42, everything is returned back to Job. That's the story of the book. Now, there are several well-known verses from this book. Chapter 1, let's look at verse 21. It's probably the most well-known, most quoted. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Probably everyone has heard that. At least the Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. It's been turned into many beautiful songs and hymns. Chapter 19, verse 25 also. I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take a stand on the earth. That's also been turned into many beautiful songs and hymns. So I think of all the verses in this book, those two are probably the ones that we are most familiar with. Now, the person I really want to focus on is Job's wife. I'm a retired oncology nurse, and I'm currently a hospice chaplain. I've attended the death of many patients. Not all deaths are pain-free. They should be, which is why I'm a big advocate of hospice. But some are not, and a bad death is an unbearable thing to have to watch. So I sympathize with Job's wife and having to watch her husband in this excruciating pain and suffering. So I want us to look a little more carefully at chapter 2 and verse 9. It says, then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Let's try to put ourselves in her place. Would you not do anything to end the suffering of someone you loved? If you believe that just simply giving up on God could end the pain, wouldn't you be tempted to go there? It's easy to make judgments, but when you're walking in those shoes, it's really difficult. Now, here's an interesting little tidbit. The word curse used here is the exact same Hebrew word that we just read in chapter 1, verse 21, where Job says, blessed be the name of the Lord. And for some reason, it's translated cursed. She could say, bless God and die. It's the exact same Hebrew word. So I would like for us to consider maybe, one other thing I want to say. This kind of hold fast to your integrity, the intent of this Hebrew is sticking through with something to the end. And what if she's just saying, don't be so stubborn. You don't have to see this through. Just bless God and let this suffering be over with. I mean, that's like a whole different way to understand maybe what she's saying. I think she's pleading through tears. Please, my love, don't insist on seeing this through. Bless God and put an end to this pain. So let's look at Job's response in verse 10, and I think it's really gentle. You speak as one of the foolish women. It could also be translated senseless. That's nonsense, honey. That's nonsense. I can't do that. I just can't go there. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? I just think that's a really gentle, sweet response. Not what you would say to a woman who's portrayed the way we usually portray her. So the other thing I want us to notice is Job's wife is the only thing that's not taken away from him. We think he's lost everything, but he hasn't lost his wife. And in the end, when he gets everything back, it doesn't say he got a new wife. So here's this woman who is with him through all of this, all the way through. And I kind of think it's time maybe we consider her story a little bit differently. That's all I wanted to say about her. Just give you something to think about. All right, next book is Psalms. Now, on one of your handouts, you have a table that looks like this. This is lesson 3, so if you weren't here last week and you didn't get a handout, they're up here. There are really no specific women to cover in this book, so I'm just going to give you a quick overview. Passages from the book of Psalms are among our most beloved verses in the whole Bible. The book derives its name from a Greek word related to the psaltery, which is an ancient harp-like instrument that David played. And as we know, David played a harp. It's actually the word psaltery. And he sang, and many of the Psalms are Davidic in origin. It's known as Israel's songbook, and includes hymns and laments and royal psalms and thanksgiving psalms. More than a third of the psalms are addressed to the director of music. Some psalms exhort the worshiper to sing. Some headings actually denote what musical instrument is to be played when the psalm is sung. Some refer to singing at the octave. Some indicate the name for the tune that it should be sung to. The psalms are used throughout traditional Jewish and Christian worship even today. Most notably, some are chanted, some are sung. In some Christian monastic traditions, the entire book is recited or chanted throughout the course of the month, so much so that the entire thing becomes memorized. And the Quran references God giving David the Psalms. So this table divides up the Psalms into categories or genres. Some are happy, some are beautifully poetic. Some, like many other places in the Bible we have talked about, contain passages that are difficult. Most notably, the imprecatory psalms. You see those listed with the lament psalms, so they're a subcategory. The imprecatory psalms are those that invoke judgment, calamity, or curses upon one's enemies, or those perceived as enemies of God. And this makes them hard to relate to, as we might have issues with asking God to wreak havoc on people, or maybe we wouldn't, I don't know. But Jesus said we should pray for our enemies, so we have kind of have a, you know, problem here. And how do we handle these passages? On the other hand, as I mentioned, some of the most beautiful passages in the Bible come from the Psalms and are a strength at times of loss, such as our beloved 23rd Psalm. So as you can see on the handout, there are a number of Psalms that are laments, which is the focus of our Lenten season this year. And all of the lament psalms, with the exception of Psalms 88, have what's called the Vav adversive. The Vav is a tiny Hebrew letter, just a little stick with a tiny flag on the top. And it's usually translated and. But it, when it's used in the format here in these lament psalms, it means but. And so you usually have this whole rant about, oh, woe is me. And I'm so bad off, and my life sucks, and everybody's against me. But you are faithful, you are God, you are good. And when you read these, you'll see, we're actually going to look at one. So I'd like for us to open up to the 22nd Psalm. Because this little but happens several times in this psalm. Many of the lament psalms, it happens once, so half the psalm or the beginning of it will have all this negative stuff and then the but. But we see here, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far away? Verse 2, I'm crying in the daytime. Verse 3, but you are holy, enthroned in praises. And then we're lamenting again. 6, I'm a worm, I'm a reproach. Everybody ridicules me. Verse 9, but you are the one that took me out of the womb. You see how that's working? Now, what I want us to notice is, let's get down to verse 19. But you, O Lord, do not be far from me, my strength. Deliver me, my precious life, from the power of the dog. Save me. You have answered me. I will declare your name. 25, my praise shall be of you in the great assembly. 27, all the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord. 29, all the prophets of the earth shall eat and worship. So there's a lot of this praise in here. So you, if you just stop with the despair, you get a whole different picture of God than if you read past the but, right? So here's the thing. This is what Jesus was quoting on the cross. Now, all we have recorded is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Period. And everybody assumes God has forsaken Jesus on the cross. Jesus had this entire thing memorized. You know, whether he said it all or not, I think the intent of his lament on the cross was the entirety of this psalm, claiming a God who is good and who is there and is with us when we are going through all this, whatever awful thing we may be going through. So maybe God isn't a divine child abuser after all. And maybe he doesn't abandon us, but he's with us no matter what we may be going through. It's just something I'd like for us to consider. All right, the next book is Proverbs. The Proverbs was written to impart wisdom. So in that regard, it's an instruction manual for daily living. It's not a history book. Many of the instructions are written in short statements or couplets in an A-B pattern. The authorship is ascribed to Solomon, although, again, there's disputes about authorship for a number of reasons that we won't go into. Agur the king and Lemuel, that L is in that name, it means devoted to God, are also contributors. Chapters 1 through 9 consist of a series of instructions given by a father to his son. And the most prominent theme in this section is the contrast between wisdom and folly. Both of these are feminine nouns. And you can find some interesting feminist literature on this subject if it's something you want to get into. But they're not just feminine nouns. They actually are personified as women. They get up and walk around, these wisdom people. The woman of folly is offered in contrast to the woman of wisdom, but she only gets a few verses in chapter 9. The next group is found in chapters 10 through 22, and these are entitled the Proverbs of Solomon. And these are the ones you typically think of, written in this couplet form. That makes them different from the ones that preceded and the ones that follow. Chapters 23 and 24 have a little different tone to them. And chapters 25 through 29 are more Proverbs of Solomon, but it states that these are copied by the men from King Hezekiah. Chapters 30 and 31 are the sayings of Agur and King Lemuel, respectively, which are Arabic names. And Proverbs 31 is probably the most famous of all the passages in the book. It is instructions from King Lemuel's mother, which he's passing on to a son, and it starts in verse 10, going through verses 31, about the attributes of a virtuous woman. So many interpret this passage as being about a virtuous wife, because that's how it's translated. But the same Hebrew word, isha, is translated in the Old Testament as wife 425 times, woman 324 times, and female 2 times. So saying Abraham's woman was Sarah is the same as saying Abraham's wife was Sarah. It's the same word. We assume this means wife, though, because in the passage it talks about her husband. So we can call her a wife. So this passage is one of the 13 alphabetic acrostic poems in the Bible. From verses 10 through 31, there are 22 verses, and there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And each verse begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So, again, the poetic form. And by the way, the word alphabet comes from the first two Hebrew letters, Aleph, Bet, just in case you didn't know that. So when you read these passages about this woman, she seems to be impossible to emulate, doesn't she? Rachel Held Evans says, as a poem, Proverbs 31 should not be interpreted prescriptively as a job for all women. Its purpose is to celebrate wisdom in action, not to instruct women everywhere to get married, have children, and take up the loom. I like to think of this passage as a personification of wisdom, which is how the book began. Wisdom, she gets up and walks around with skin on, and this is how wisdom would look. So this whole section's third person. The only direct actual instruction is in verse 31, which is to a male audience that they should give her the fruit of their hands and praise her in the gates. So I'm thinking, instead of preaching a load of guilt to women on Mother's Day, because this woman is impossible, What if we approached it as this is an example of what wisdom looks like? And that person is confident. They look after others' best interests. They are profitable business persons. They are wise investors of those profits. They are industrious and particularly good with their hands. Although they don't worry about the future, they plan for it and are always prepared. They seek justice, walk humbly, and address the needs around them as they are presented, especially the poor and the needy. They take care of themselves, but don't take themselves too seriously, always remembering to laugh. They are strong physically, mentally, and spiritually. They are wise and speak from an informed faith. Now, can't that be all of us? Can't we all aspire to that? Now, having read that with the thought of, could this be wisdom getting up and walking around, let's go back to chapter 9, and let me read to you verses 1 through 6. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She's slaughtered her meat. She's mixed her wine. She's furnished her table. She set out her maidens. She cries out from the highest places of the city. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. As for him who lacks understanding, she says, come, eat of my bread and drink of the wine I've mixed. Forsake foolishness and live and go in the way of understanding. Can't we understand them both in the same way? All right, Ecclesiastes. That's the next little book. It's easy to skip over it because it's just a few short chapters. The self-claimed author of Ecclesiastes is the son of David in verse 1. Solomon, of course, is one of David's sons, and he became king after him. This book is therefore ascribed to Solomon because of its wisdom and because he claims to be a son of David. The author has become aware of the mistakes he's made through his life, and he wishes to hand down his wisdom to his son so that the son will not make the same mistakes as the father. It's made up again of proverbs, philosophical principles, and sayings, and is existential in nature, which means if you are into existential philosophy, it's very pessimistic, bordering on fatalistic. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, or it can be translated meaninglessness. I believe this book would be better interpreted as seeing an image of what life is like without God, not taking it literally that everything sucks. But without God, it could, right? If this is all there is, there's no God, all we have is our own efforts, life can be empty. Some of the more well-known passages, however, are, let's look at them together. It's chapter 1, verse 9. There's, at the end of that little verse, there's nothing new under the sun. We've heard that, haven't we? Over in verse 18, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. That's where we get ignorance is bliss. Chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, a very beloved passage. We're not going to read the whole thing, but for every time, there's a purpose under heaven, and then it goes through all those times. Same chapter, verse 11. He's made everything beautiful in its time. You've seen that in plaques and sayings. And I really love this. In the same verse, he has set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom that God has what God has done from beginning to end. That's such a deep thought, the fact that God puts in us this eternity of longing, but filling that with God, trying to understand God, is something that we will never get to the end of. God is so much beyond what we could ever imagine. I love that verse. And chapter 9, verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. So those for me are some of the more popular verses. There's actually no women mentioned by name in this book. There's one reference to women, and it's in chapter 7, verses 26 and 28, and it's very negative. Given Solomon's disastrous experience with his 1,000 women, no wonder he came to such conclusions as there isn't a woman alive worth his time. One reference said that these two verses were the most misogynist passages in all the Bible. Okay, Song of Songs. That's our Song of Solomon, you may have in your Bible. So, warning, if you're uneasy talking about sex, you're going to need to close your ears for this part of the discussion. The Song of Songs is also called the Song of Solomon because it's ascribed to Solomon in verse 1. There's a bunch of debates with scholars about this authorship. We won't go there. Solomon wrote 1,005 songs in his lifetime. We're told that in 1 Kings 4 and verse 32. But this is the song of all the songs. You know, we'll study the book of Revelation before we'll study this book. And studying the book of Revelation is kind of rare, isn't it? I mean, in my 65 years, I have never had a Sunday school class on this book. How many of you have one? Okay. Well, we avoid it like the plague, assuming that this book could not possibly be taken literally, an opinion that is influenced by a shame culture associated with sex. It's one of the two books of the Bible where God is not mentioned. Remember Esther, the word God is not in it. Although many scholars state that Esther's the only book with this distinction, and this is because the popular interpretation of this book is an allegory of God's love for Israel, and Christians like to refer to it as Christ's love for the church. So either way, it's felt through the allegory that God is implied. So that's why they say that Esther's the only book with God not in it. Medieval monastic mystics were well known for their religious ecstatic experiences that on the surface can sound very akin to orgasmic ecstasy. These experiences were characterized by greatly reduced external awareness and expanded interior, mental, and spiritual awareness, frequently accompanied by visions and emotional, sometimes physical, euphoria. We have the writings of many of these mystics who've conveyed spiritual union with God in virtually sexual terms. Mechtild of Magdeburg, Catherine of Genoa, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, this is just a few. The sacrament of communion has been explained as a physical union with Christ and is described in images of marriage and sexual consummation. The image of bride or lover was clearly a central metaphor for the mystic's union with Christ. And the 12th century Hildegard von Bingen dressed her nuns as brides when they went forward to receive communion. So viewing this book as a metaphor for the love between God and Israel or Christ and the church isn't a far stretch. It's one of the few books in the Bible that features a woman's voice. The characters are not named, but there are three prominent voices. The female lover, forced into labor by her family as a vineyard worker. The male lover, a handsome and stately shepherd. We're not given his name, but Solomon is implied because of the discussion about Solomon's wedding parade. And a chorus, a community of people celebrating the man's and the woman's love. The lovers refer to each other with pet names in Hebrew, Dodi, my beloved, which the female calls the male, and Reati, my love, which the male calls the female. It contains dialogue between the lovers, dialogue between the woman and the daughters of Jerusalem, loving description of each other by the man and the woman's dreams about the man, praises of the woman's beauty. It's extremely hard to interpret the words because it has the most hapax legomen, are words that only appear one time in the entire Bible of any book in the Old Testament. One interpreter reminds us that if this were indeed an arranged song, thinking of it musically, we would think of it as a duet in a choir with three musical movements. The bride and groom prepare for the wedding, the bride and groom profess their desire for one another, the bride and groom are finally united. So that's an easy way to think about it. Many interpreters, assuming that the biblical account cannot possibly sanction sex outside of marriage, remember we've talked about the sexual mores, and they're quite different than what we think of as now. So, but in our 20th century, 21st century mindset, the Bible can't possibly be talking about sex outside of marriage. And they refer to the characters as a bride and groom who pine for each other but don't actually consummate their relationship until after the wedding. Some interpreters read this as lovers who have consummated their relationship outside of marriage. In either case, if there is no premarital consummation, there's at least some heavy petting going on. Some scholars interpret there being only one woman lover. Others interpret there being two different ones. We have a specific reference only once, chapter 6, verse 13, where she's called a Shulamite. This is interpreted as meaning that she's from the town of Shulam, or possibly the town of Shunem, very similar, or that this is her name. The meaning of Shulamite is translated as peaceful. What we know from her is how she's described, that she's breathtakingly beautiful. She was tan, which was actually a negative thing back then. It's variously translated as black or swarthy or dark in chapter 1, verse 5. And this was a result of her having to work in the vineyard, which it was right in the next verse of verse 6. Or some assume as possibly she was from Egypt or Africa. Most assume that she was young, because brides back then were always young. But I think she's young because she compares her breasts to towers and not to pancakes. That's in chapter 8, verse 10, in case you need the reference. There are four sections referred to as wasifs. It's an Arabic word for description, where the lovers compare various body parts to other things, such as eyes like doves, cheeks like pomegranate halves, lips like lilies, and these get quite explicit. Some of these comparisons sound strange to us, but if someone were to read our comparisons 2,000 years from now, they too might scratch their heads when they read about washboard abs or abs like a six-pack. Maybe this book should be taken for just what it is, two lovers who delight in each other. God made us this way, and there's nothing about our bodies or what bodies are made to do of which we should be ashamed. I think we should read it as the great sex romp that it is. And let's look at just a couple descriptions. So chapter 4, verse 16. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south. Blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. And we go, wink, wink, nod, nod. Chapter 7, verses 7 and 8. The stature of yours is like a palm tree, your breasts like its clusters. And I said, I will go up to the palm tree and take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples. It's beautiful language, actually. I think maybe we should just go home and read it to each other. Maybe it'll spark something. Who knows? Some of the verses that we see, like in plaques and posted on things, are actually quite lovely. Chapter 1, verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Chapter 2 and 4, he has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. And we see that like reference to God, just the last part, his banner over me is love. Probably the most quoted and seen plastered on walls is 2:16. My lover is mine and I am theirs. Chapter 4, verse 9. You've captured my heart, my treasure, my spouse. You hold it hostage with one glance of your eyes. And the next verse in 10. Your love delights me, my treasure, my spouse. Your love is better than wine, your smell more fragrant than spices. So I encourage you to read through it. And with that, we have finished the entire Old Testament in 3.5 weeks. Now, let's do a little review. And Marilyn can't answer. Okay. So somebody asked me earlier, where would I find information about Samson? Was Samson a king or a judge? Who said?
He's a judge.
He's a judge. So what book do I find about the judges? Judges. Yeah. So if you wanted to find out about Samson, you would go Judges. Or Deborah, she was a judge. She'd be in the book of Judges. If I wanted to read about the patriarchs, the ones who came before the children of Israel went off to wander, what book would those be in? Say it again.
Genesis.
So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all those guys, right? If I wanted to know about Moses and the Exodus and the giving of the Ten Commandments, where would that book be?
Exodus.
Okay. So Genesis, Exodus, and then the next three are kind of history and law, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, those first five books. Once you get past those, then you have the guy who took over after Moses. What was his name? He was with Moses.
Huh?
Joshua. Joshua took leadership after Moses, and he has a whole book that follows right after all those Moses books, right? So Joshua comes next, and then we have the period before the kings called the judges. The rest of the books of history are all about the time during the kings. So we have 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. Then we have books related to captivity, coming back from captivity, Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah. The little books can get lost in there. And then we get in, and Ruth is in there. Then we get into the poetry books that we just covered, right? And after the poetry books are all the books of the prophets. Now, they're major and minor. Do anyone remember why they're called major and minor?
The length.
The length. So the major ones are bigger books. And then you have that handout that shows which prophets were during which kings. So they all get kind of convoluted, but if you can remember Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, those are the big ones. And then the rest of them, I even myself have to either run through the list in my mind or go to the table of contents, because those little books just, they all start sounding alike, don't they? Something Iah, Zephaniah, Zechariah, Jeremiah. Okay, now, before we jump into lesson four, let's check our time. Some of you have talked to me about the fact that we're going really fast. We're covering a lot of material. I just want to remind you that this was billed as covering the entire Bible in 5 to 6 weeks. So that's a lot of information in a short period of time. And that's why I thought it was important to record it. So I encourage you to go back and listen to the recording so you can pause it and think about it and spend more time. Okay? Good. All right. Now, what I've decided to do, and we probably won't finish this today, but is to prepare us to get into the New Testament, because there are 400 years that happens between when the Old Testament closes and we open up the New Testament, and all of a sudden we're reading about things that we've never heard of before. And I think for us to understand the meaning of some of that stuff and how it plays out, it would be good to sort of review that. So we're going to spend some time talking about all those new things and where they came from. And then we'll get into a quick review of what's in each of the books and talk about a few of the women. We're not going to talk about all of them, just like we didn't talk about all of them in the Old Testament. So that's why you have a lot of maps in your handouts. So, of course, we'll be starting with Gospels, and the word Gospel comes from an old English word, Godspell, which is where that musical comes from. It means good news or glad tidings. The Greek word translated as Gospel in the New Testament is Evangelion, which means good message or good news, and from which we get the word evangelist, as someone who literally goes out spreading good news. Now, the summary of what the Gospels are about is Jesus' life. It includes his birth narratives, a little bit about him at age 12 at the temple. Then we jump to the temptation in the wilderness, baptism, and the beginning of his 3 years of ministry. The crucifixion, the resurrection, and ascension. That's kind of it in a nutshell. They inform us about what Jesus did, where he went, miracles he performed, and what he said, his teachings. They also inform us about what others did in relation to Jesus and what others said about Jesus. It's important to understand Jesus' life from a first century Jewish perspective. Let's remember that Yeshua ben Joseph, which would have been his legal name, was a Jew born to Jewish parents in a Jewish land. His life and death were a fulfillment of Jewish prophecy. Everything about what we call the church and early Christianity was founded in the context of first century Judaism. They did not think that Jesus came to start a new church. They believed that he came to fulfill the law and all righteousness. In fact, Jesus himself says in Matthew 15:17, I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. So we're going to talk about what that means. I think a greater understanding of this context can enrich our understanding of the Christian Bible or New Testament. So each of the four Gospels tells a story of Jesus' life from a different perspective. And you have a little table there that goes over that. Sorry about the double header. I don't know why I did that. It's assumed that Matthew was one of the 12 disciples. This is debated, of course. His audience was fellow Jews. He assumed that they understood the Old Testament. And his purpose is to convince people that this is the fulfillment of all that prophecy. That's why his genealogy is just focused on the house of David and it only goes back to Abraham. He knows that Jews are going to know the rest of the genealogy from Abraham. Now, many think that Mark was probably John Mark who traveled with Paul. I want to make sure we understand that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were not all disciples. When people say, list off the 12 disciples, we start with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and that's, you know, they're not all disciples. So we know that that Mark was not. He's writing to a Roman audience, so a Jewish genealogy wouldn't be of any interest to them, so we have no genealogy in his book. He emphasizes the servant nature of Jesus and his followers who would emulate him. It's action-packed. It contains many miracles. Many believe that Mark's gospel was written first and that Luke and Matthew borrowed some things for their accounts from Mark's history. Many stories are similar between the three books, while John is like a completely different book. And that's why the first three gospels are called synoptic gospels, if you've ever heard that phrase. Synoptic from the Greek term syn, where we get synonym, which means same, and optic, which means sight. So similar sight, similar ways of viewing things. Luke was a physician by trade, and this is part one of a two-part letter he writes to Theophilus. The second part is the book of Acts. It reads like a traveling narrative. He writes like a journalistic historian. Jesus is always on his way from one place to the next in Luke's gospel. Luke emphasizes that Jesus is a real person who is genuinely interested in people, especially women and those who were less fortunate. Some things to note about Luke's genealogy are that it's identical to Matthew's between Abraham and David, but differs from that point. Luke covers Abraham to Adam, which was not in Matthew's, and traditional Christian scholars have put forward various theories that seek to explain the differences, the most popular being that Matthew's account follows the lineage of Joseph, while Luke's account follows the lineage of Mary. Modern critical scholars claim that both genealogies were made up in order to give substance to the messianic claims, but we don't have time for all that mess. Okay, John refers to himself in this gospel account as the disciple whom Jesus loved in 19 and 26. He's the one resting his head on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper. He is writing to a global audience, so there's no need for a Jewish genealogy. His emphasis is to convince the reader that Jesus is God among us, Emmanuel, and to get the reader to become a believer. So it's evangelistic in nature. Much of what we read in John is unique to John. That is, you don't find it in the other three gospel accounts. The one thing I like to contemplate is where these writers are getting their information. For example, Jesus' private conversation with Mary at the wedding in Cana. Or Jesus praying, "Not my will, but thine," when everybody was supposedly asleep. I have my theories, but I'll say that for another time. There are several things we need to consider when we open up the New Testament. The first, as I mentioned, is that 400 years have passed between the Testaments. So when we open it up, we read about things we've never heard of, like Pharisees and synagogues. So I think it's important to understand what has occurred in those intervening years. This time is referred to as the intertestament period by Protestants and the deuterocanonical period by Catholics and Orthodox. So first I want to talk about the political climate. So understanding what has been going on politically, I think, is critical. It's important to remember we closed the Old Testament with the Assyrians first taking the captives in the northern kingdom, and your map number 1 and 2 shows the Assyrians kind of came in from the north east, and so that's why they took the northern kingdom captive. Remember, the northern kingdom was 10 tribes, also called Israel. We call them the lost tribes because we don't really have any good accounts of them ever coming back as a group. Now, the Babylonians took the southern kingdom into captivity. It's referred to as Judah, but the tribe of Benjamin was also included in that. Old Testament biblical history closes with the return of those captives and rebuilding the temple. So they go back into that Judean Jerusalem area. Now, Babylon was a kingdom in ancient Mesopotamia from the 18th to the 6th centuries B.C. The city's ruins lie in what's modern-day Iraq, about 60 miles southwest of Baghdad. It was once the largest city in the world. And you can see it in the bottom. The smaller dotted area was the Babylonian area. The land of Israel was a hotly contested and favorable location. It was at the crossroads of the ancient world. It was bordered on the west by the Mediterranean Sea, on the east by the Arabian Desert. So it was a major trade route between Egypt and the lands of Mesopotamia and Asia Minor. So the Babylonian Empire fell to the Persian Empire, and it's the second black dotted area that you see there. The Medes and then the Persians are in the red. And there's a history with that we won't go into. The entire area eventually fell to the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great, which you see on map 3. Get all my maps out. So you see how large the Greek Empire became. It's that orange area. Having become a world empire, they invaded Palestine. With them, they brought their language and culture. Their architecture, names, styles of clothing, entertainment, the influence of the Greeks was long-lasting. The entire New Testament is written in Greek. And the Old Testament was translated into a Greek version at around 284 BC. And that's known as the Septuagint, which means 70, because there were 70 translators. The Hellenists were a group of Jews who read the scriptures in the Septuagint translation rather than in Hebrew, and who spoke Greek rather than Aramaic. And you'll see the Septuagint referred to in print as LXX. Or some people will actually say the LXX. They're talking about the Septuagint. That's the Roman numeral for 70. Alexander's empire broke into four parts, two of which are important for understanding the context of the New Testament. The first group, the Ptolemies, were centered in Egypt and ruled over Palestine. They treated the Jews well, but eventually the Seleucids, the second group, took control, and they were brutal. They forced pagan religion on the Jews and set up an altar to Zeus in the temple, offering pigs as sacrifice. So this resulted in a rebellion, which you may have heard of, the Maccabean Revolt. As a result of this revolt, the Jews gained their independence, which lasted until about 63 BC when the Romans took control. Pompey conquered the eastern Mediterranean, including Palestine. Julius Caesar conquered Gaul. So Rome dominated Palestine from that point on. And you can see the Roman Empire on map 4. So it's got this dotted outline. Okay, everybody's with me? Octavian, Julius Caesar's adopted son, took control after Caesar's assassination. Octavian is the same name as Caesar Augustus that we read about in the story of Jesus' birth in Luke chapter 2, who required the census. So there are some issues with the dating of the census, but we're not going to discuss that. Rome placed governors over areas dividing up the empire, and they appear regularly throughout the New Testament. Pontius Pilate was a governor who presided over the trial of Jesus. The Romans also allowed native people to rule the lands they conquered. So in Palestine, Herod the Great was ruling at the time of Jesus' birth. Herod's father was a descendant of Esau, actually. Herod was raised as a Jew. While he was a clever politician and an efficient ruler, he was also very cruel and consistently suspicious. He had all three of his wives and three of his sons killed for that reason. Jesus was born under Herod the Great's rule, and his family fled to Egypt to escape the massacre of the innocents, as it's referred to, when he said that all male babies under 2 years old should be killed. He's best known for his building projects in Palestine, the greatest of which was the Temple at Jerusalem. So Herod died in 4 BC, which is why Jesus' birth is considered to be around 4 to 6 BC. And the Romans divided his kingdom into four parts. Galilee is where Herod Antipas ruled, where Jesus grew up and spent most of his public ministry. So on your lesson handout, you have this little topographical map, which really gives us a good visual, kind of a satellite view for the area. So Jerusalem, as we'll look at in another map, is kind of in the middle. This is the Dead Sea, the little blue sea at the bottom, the little tiny one at the top, the Sea of Galilee. Up by the Sea of Galilee is where Galilee is and Nazareth was. And Jesus grew up. Down near the top of the Dead Sea is where Jerusalem is and the temple. Can you see how mountainous and rugged this terrain is? We don't appreciate that when we're just looking at a regular little map, right? Also, the area of the Galilee, you see how it's kind of reddish, dark? There's a lot more vegetation. It's a lot more lush up in Galilee, whereas down in Judea, it becomes sparser in vegetation. So now I want to look at map 6. Because I want us to locate Nazareth. So you see up here at the top where Galilee is, by this little Sea of Galilee? There's Capernaum, Cana, Nazareth, Mount Tabor. Do you all see that? Nazareth was one of the most beautiful places in all of Galilee. It's situated in this pear-shaped basin and surrounded by limestone hills. But when you climb out of the basin, you can see 30 miles in three directions. Still, it's considered a small, nothing town. Provincials were divorced from the main issues of national life and were susceptible to the ministry of powerful personalities. They were backward. They were from the sticks. This also explains Nathanael's reaction to hearing about a prophet from Galilee in John 1, 45 and 46, where we're told Philip goes and finds Nathanael and tells him that they found the Messiah, and Nathanael says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It was about 65 miles from Nazareth to Jerusalem, more if you took a detour around Samaria, which we'll talk about. Travel from Jerusalem, of course, was on foot and was usually divided up over at least 3 days, which means you'd walk 20 to 25 miles a day. People would travel together in large groups. Okay, now I'm checking the time, and it's almost 15 after. So I think we'll pick up with Galilee next week and then jump into some of the women in the Gospels. Bring all your handouts back. See y'all next week.